Well, thanks for coming, everyone. I think we're about ready to get started. My name's Marshall Kirkpatrick. Right now, I'm the Director of Content at Portland, Oregon-based Splashcast Media. In my previous job, I was a writer at TechCrunch, and I'm going to be moderating this panel on Distribution 2.0. We've got representatives from four different companies that are all doing very innovative, interesting things around distributing content in a variety of different capacities. I'm just going to let them first introduce themselves down the line. Then we will have some short explanations of what the various companies are doing in the distribution space. We'll follow that by a fascinating conversation about the burning issues in the field. And then we'll open up to a full question and answer. If people want to raise their hands and ask any questions during the first discussion period, feel free to do so. And if whoever's speaking at the time feels like taking a question, we can do a little bit of that way as well. So with that, I will move to my left and let speakers begin by introducing themselves.
Thank you. I'm Aaron from Box.net. Box.net is basically an easy way to share and access files online. So we have over 750,000 registered users that use our service to send files to family members, collaborate on projects, post music or photos to their blog, and many other sort of use cases among those. We also have an open API that's used by services like NetVibes and GUI that allow their users to access their files from their website.
I'm Chris Gottschalk, president and CTO of Coolabyte. We are a video encoding company and can't have distribution 2.0 without video. And so we have several claims to fame, if there is any fame to be had at this early stage of we are able to leverage multiple core computers, so anything from quad cores to, we've got 16 core computers from AMD, and they keep going up and up, and we can use 100% processors utilization across any given processor or core. And it gives you just extremely fast video encoding for single clips, up to 16 times faster, and better qualities to boot. So it's a exciting time, good convergence with multi-cores and Coolabyte.
Hi, I'm Milena Berry. I'm the co-founder of Amiglia. Amiglia is enables families to build interactive family trees together. As well as to share the most recent photos and videos. It's a family 2.0 site.
And I'm Jonathan Bryce, and I'm a co-founder of a company called Moso. We're a Rackspace venture company. And I don't know if you've heard of Rackspace Managed Hosting, but they do dedicated servers. My partner Todd and I, we left a couple years ago from Rackspace to start a similar company that's focused on clustered hosting for web designers and web developers.
Great. So those are the personalities involved and the businesses. One of the things that we've noticed is that there aren't direct competitors on this panel, but rather there's people working at a number of different stages in the distribution supply chain. So we think that'll lend to a particularly interesting conversation. So now I want to give the panelists, if they'd like to, a few minutes piece to describe their business in some more detail with an emphasis on how they perform or facilitate content distribution.
Sure. So today we started out originally as basically an online file manager. So the premise was very simple. It was that you had this space on the internet that you could put your files in, and then you could go to any computer and you could share it with anyone. Recently, we've moved into more of a distribution model where it's really convenient and easy for you to share with sort of the people in your network. So this is, close relatives. These are business collaborators. And this is also if you spread out the network a little bit further, if you're fans of a particular musician or if you're fans of a particular organization or a member of an organization, it's a really easy way to share information within that community. And we are now rolling out a lot of features that are very specific to that need, dealing specifically with the file element of sharing. So your photos, your videos, audio clips, that type of data.
Okay. Let's see. You thought you were all going to escape it, but here comes the dreaded PowerPoint. Let's see. Maybe. Come on. There we go. Okay, distribution 2.0 and video. So, anybody ever encode audio? It's real fast right here in 2007. Guess what? Video encoding is extremely slow. You know, the technical standpoints of that, it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot more to analyze. But the pain is still the same. It just takes forever to encode, just even a single, piece of content, let alone large volumes of content. So our main focus is twofold. First is to, increase the encoding times, because I know everybody's got to be, if anybody's half as impatient as I am, then you got to have faster video encoding. You know, I'm a race car fan. You know, can't handle NASCAR. It takes way too long to figure out who's the winner. Drag racing is a whole lot more fun. You know, 4 or 5 seconds, you got a winner. So that's kind of, where this all spawned from, was, my own, impatience. So, you know, we got a couple things that we do, that are real benefits to our process. First is, if anybody's ever done live video, normally, if you ever used Windows Media Encoder, you've got, you know, this nice GUI. It's got all these options for, say, a file encode, but then you hit that live broadcast button and they all get grayed out. You can't use a darn thing. You got to use the specific modes and these limited options to get your live video out. And of course, looks a great deal less in quality than your normal file-to-file encode. So we've actually got something, because of the way we handle our ingest, the actual workflow. We allow live streams to be handled like you would a file. So that means things like a live two-pass VBR mode in a live encode, which you know, most broadcast engineers turn up their nose. That makes no sense. And it kind of doesn't make any sense, but you know, the results are the same. And you get those excellent qualities like you do on a normal file encode, but on a live stream. So you actually get some live broadcasts that people will want to watch on the web, especially with Flash, the new VP6. The other thing we do is, I'm going to jump here to 100% processor utilization. That's a 16 core AMD server, 32 cores. They'll have to us maybe before the big NAB show in April. But that's a single video encode. That's a Flash 8, and you know, 10-minute clip normally takes you know, say 40-50 minutes to encode. You know, real slow. We did that in about 30 seconds. So just unbelievably fast encoding if you've got the right iron, which you know, commodity hardware is coming down in price. So that's kind of where we are. We're a lot about speed, a lot about quality. Normally two things you can't get in one hit, but we're doing it, and we'll be unveiling our products here in April, so stay tuned. Let you jump in there.
So I'm just going to jump through a couple of slides here as well, describing Amiga in a little bit more detail for those of you who are not acquainted with what we are about. Basically, Amiglia was created out of a site that we started for our own family, for the Barry family. My father-in-law was working on a site to gather all the family photos, videos, and documents in one place, and he put a lot of work into it. And then my husband's sisters, my sisters-in-law, they all are married and have little ones. And as much as we wanted them to contribute to berries.amiglia.com, we realized that they aren't a Barry anymore. They were either Parsons or Yosifov or Fanwi. They were part of a different family. And they wanted to have their own Amiglia site. They wanted to have, you know, Parsons.amiglia.com or something like this. So Amiglia really mimics the way families work, in which there's like many nuclear families that overlap each other. Like the mother of one family is the sister in another family, and it's the daughter of a different family. So we created a site that lets families network the way they do in real life. So really, what you can share in between those sites are people. And then over time, we also developed photo sharing, video sharing, music sharing, and you also can build together maps, calendars, and different albums. I'm concentrating this presentation, by the way, on the things that are unique about us. Since there's a lot of photo and video sharing sites out there, I'm just concentrating on what's really unique about Amiglia. And the one thing that really differentiates us from all of the photo sharing sites out there is our interactive family tree. This is just a little demo of it, but you can see family members can be represented with either a photo or a video thumbnail. You can browse the different branches. You can click on different branches and expand that site. This is just showing you a very brief intro to how our interactive family works. When you browse over somebody, you can see their kid, etc. We also proud ourselves to be a next generation genealogy app. If you're aware, Ancestry.com has been on the genealogy market for a while, and people use them for genealogy research. But we feel like we're the Web 2.0 of genealogy apps by being a collaborative genealogy tool. And the other thing that's unique about us is that we allow that genealogy research to be represented by rich media like photos, videos, music, and more. We have other stuff like you can share a family calendar where you can see whose birthday is coming up and when photos were taken across the family. And the related families. We also let you build satellite or road maps. So if the family takes a trip, you can use, geotagging kind of functions to build your own map overlaid with satellite and road maps. And the cool thing about Amiglia is that you don't get per family member account, but you get a family account altogether. So where before the grandmother, if she's invited to, say, Shutterfly or something, has to really log in with her own login, now you can share one password across the family. So this is just like a brief introduction. I'm not really going to get into more. If you guys have any questions, we can discuss them later.
All right. Well, I don't have a presentation, but I'll just tell you a little bit more in detail about MOSO and what our specific mission is. Todd and I had been doing web design and web development before we started working at Rackspace, and that was over 7 years ago. And while we were at Rackspace, Rackspace employees get back then it was free. Now I think it's $5 or $10 servers. It's a great benefit, you know. But on the side, we just like building web apps, and so we were taking on freelance work and building web applications, and then hosting them on our own servers. And that part of my day job too was system administration work and running a cluster of servers that was powering some of Rackspace's applications. But after we got about 10 or 15 customers on these servers, we realized that it was not really just side work anymore. Managing multiple servers, it's like having a bunch of cars. There's always one that's broken. It's always one that you got to work on. There's some hard drive that failed. You're restoring from backup or once you get users, then you have to help them. You have to explain how to set up email, which is usually not billable time. So we looked around in the market, and we didn't really see anything that fit the situation that we were in, and that we knew some of our web design and web development coworkers and partners were in. So we went to Rackspace, and we pitched this idea for MOSO, which is basically taking hosting to more of a utility model than it had been before. And really building a way where people like us who just wanted to build web applications, database-driven applications using different technologies, they could do that very easily with no startup time and affordably. And then important to us was that it'd be reliable and scalable. Because especially with Web 2.0, you have Dig and Slashdot's been around for a while, but you have all of these sites where you can become famous overnight, and in a matter of hours, you get 10 or 15 or 20 times the traffic that you're used to, and trying to manage that kind of growth on your own can be a real headache. So we wanted to come up with an infrastructure platform that could handle that kind of load and that kind of scalability, and then on top of it, build a great web application that was specifically designed for people like us who wanted to create lots of sites, lots of databases, and just spend their time doing what they love to do and not administering servers and worrying about hardware and infrastructure.
Great. So those are the companies that our panelists are all representing, not just because they brought me here, but also because I think they're a fantastic way to distribute content. I should briefly explain the company that I work for, Splashcast. We provide a way for people to display and distribute multiple items across mixed media types, videos, photos, audio, and text frames, all in one embeddable Flash player that looks like a single YouTube video, but contains an entire library of mixed media content. And when people embed a player that includes the same channel of content that they see on your website, they'll receive all future shows or new content published to your channel, pushed out automatically by RSS whenever that channel is updated. So that's at splashcastmedia.com. I won't do a demonstration per se, but that's my personal involvement in media distribution. So with that, I want to kick off a conversation with what I think is a fundamental question for media distribution companies these days that some of our panelists probably have to deal with more than others today, but that presumably all of them will, if especially multimedia distribution by users continues to get easier and easier. And that's the question of copyright. I'd like to possibly just go right down the line, since it is such a fundamental question, and ask each of the panelists what they believe, as a distribution-related company, their obligation is in regards to copyrighted content.
Sure. Well, we're definitely obligated to respect the copyrights that are being held. That being said, historically, Box.net has been an online file manager for your personal files. And so in that type of use case, you can upload, you know, content that you've purchased and, you know, keep it in your sort of storage locker, and pull it down from back to your computer at a later time. The interesting challenge is when we've opened up our platform and turned it into more of a sharing app and more of a sharing service, and, you know, running into the difficulties of content being shared on blogs and websites that isn't supposed to be. So the first, you know, the biggest measure that we've taken recently is reaching out to publishers and content providers and offering them a legal means by which they can, you know, let our users share content. You know, we think that's the best sort of the best mix of everything, because we can provide special tools for content publishers, such as making, you know, music not downloadable but stream only, for instance, and offering these types of sort of precautions for the content publishers, so they can give you know, regular users the you know, an easy way to share information. So, and I think we're probably, as an industry, watching, you know, people like iMeme and, you know, working together with Snowcap and sort of seeing how the revenue sharing model can work out in these types of situations. Box is not an ad driven product, so we make our money off of our subscription service. So small businesses and individuals that want to share you know, larger files or more files, they pay us a small fee. So we can't necessarily do an ad split, but we do have other sort of means by which we can make it sort of a lucrative for both parties, both the content publisher and the distributor.
Well, so content holders, as users, you want to hate them because you want everything for free. It's always in the open source world that some of us dream about. You know, everything would be freely distributable. And would be, you know, one of those happy feel-good times. But unfortunately, you know, money makes the world go round, and the copyright holders have got to be paid their dues, or else they will come after you. So it's important to keep their rights in mind as you go to distribute content. You know, DRM, you know, of course, as a video a company, we deal with that on a, you know, daily basis. You know, everything's got to be accounted for so that they can keep producing content. And you know, that's kind of the gist of it. You gotta make sure that as successful companies, even like YouTube, Google, you know, they've got to account for this copyright, so as to not take the heat from these IP holders. And I think it's up to us as the new technology companies that come up to kind of find a a way that, that keeps their rights in mind. And, but at the same time, you know, you gotta, you know, not be so obtrusive to the user that, they just don't bother anymore. And then they go, you know, to BitTorrent, you know, the heck with this, video site, let's just go BitTorrent. So you gotta make it, there's, some compromise to be made. And, unfortunately, I don't know it. If I did, I'd be on, you know, Fortune magazine. But, well, maybe you guys have got some other views.
Well, for us, I don't think copyright's been an issue so far, in that usually the Amiga content is shared just strictly in the family network and not with the whole wild world. Probably the one area of Amiga in which we kind of approach breaching that is letting families upload music to accompany their slideshows. But since that music is just stream only, as you said, we don't feel like this, it can be reproduced, for commercial purposes in any way. And we feel that the ethics of, well, this is my favorite song and sharing it with the 15 other people in your family is, can get us in legal trouble. I don't know, maybe time will prove otherwise. But if, you know, we're not talking about streaming it to a million people. We're talking about 15 of your family, really. Listening to it, so I don't know.
With from a hosting perspective, we basically turn space over to our customers, and they can put whatever they want on it. And the Congress has passed laws that specify what we need to do. And for us, it's usually a reactive thing. It's very hard to come up with a way to monitor file systems that are as large as we deal with, but we do have to put we have a team in place that is our compliance and AUP department. They handle copyrights and then also just illegal content that usually it's centered around child pornography or things like that, and those are issues that we have to deal with fairly frequently, and it's a fine line to walk too, because our customer may not understand why what they're doing is illegal. They think they're just putting it up to share it, or, you know, with some friends, or they really like this song, or they really like this video. But there is unfortunately a lot of restrictions and legalities in place. I hope that as the, as these different distribution models get going, and hopefully the legal system will catch up with the market, and copyright holders definitely deserve their due, and it does cost money to produce the content, but there's some balance, and like Chris, I don't know what it is yet, but for now we just have to enforce the law.
And to give a little credit to content holders, they have been looking for legal means, you know, by which they can provide their users and at the end of the day, our users to share things. So we found some pretty good avenues that we go through now to let fans start, you know, listening and possibly sharing music that they want. Because at the end of the day, it has been sort of, you know, while it's not so measurable, it is benefiting the artist, assuming that the end user has a legal way to go out and buy or contribute to that artist's revenue.
So over the last few months, to stick on this topic for just a second, YouTube has been presented with legal documents demanding usernames by Fox and most recently by Mark Cuban's Magnolia Pictures. And the debate in the blogosphere has been such where many people have said, well, it's a clear-cut case if you've got and particularly if you're legally compelled to do so, then that's that. But then there are other people who've said, no, on principle, it's wrong to give up usernames. And that vendors ought to challenge that legally. I wonder if any of you have any big picture thoughts on that very real dilemma that's going on.
Well, for the situation we're in, under the regulations, it's mainly the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is the main one that applies to us. We generally are, if we're given notice, it's normally a cease and desist type of notice. Mm-hmm. And those we contact our client and, tell them, you know, the situation and inform them that they're going to have to take this content down. I don't know of a situation yet that we've gotten into where we've been requested or someone has tried to force us to give user details over. I'm not sure how we would react in that situation until we get there and see what the details of it would be. But in general, you know, we handle those internally, and that's how most of the laws are structured right now. So as a service provider, you are responsible for the content on your infrastructure, and it's your duty to comply with the copyright holder's request in terms of removing it if it's being illegally distributed or published. But I don't know of anything that that requires you to pass on information about the users.
Yeah, I think it's probably just scare tactics. I mean, you want to, you know, it's when the user does it once, you know, they, of course, the hosting services, they give out all the notices, you know, block the IP, kill the user account. But that second time or third time around, you know, you create a new account, they do the same thing again. There's probably a little choice, but to eventually you just got to give it over, or else, you know, in YouTube's and Google's, you know, they have to fear the content deals as well. You know, do this for me or else you don't get this content deal. And, you know, they're holding them hostage, but there's not a whole lot they can do if they want to. Again, they got to be able to have the services. So it's either give in or that's it. You don't get the deal. So I can sympathize.
So last question on this topic, just out of curiosity, who's got the most power in that situation? The distributors or the big content holders?
Content holders.
I think it's a mirage. It's really the distributors. I mean, if you got no way to get your content out in the world, you got no money.
Yeah, are you saying as an aggregate or just on a case by case basis?
Well, yes.
You need to distribute the content. So
yeah. So,
but yeah. I mean, you know, we've certainly removed all content that's been infringing when we've been notified. To date, we haven't given out any user information. But then again, it hasn't been a large legal threat on our part. So it hasn't been much of an issue. But you know, it is a serious question when you get to YouTube size. When you do actually have some power and you have some muscle to say no to those kind of things. But then you have the same issue of if you do say no, then you have bigger deals to be lost as well.
Yeah. At the same time, you've got so say you're YouTube and you've got this content deal and they're got these demands. You tell them, well, I mean, sure, you're YouTube. I mean, you're Google. You've got all this money. You've got all these, you know, money's going flowing back to the IP holders. But you would think that okay, so the distributors have got all the real power because without the IP holders need to get their content out somehow. But I think the fear is, you know, there's always somebody else. There's always MySpace. There's always someone who is willing to give. And so I think that it's kind of a standoff, you know.
Well,
so.
And one other thing that's interesting is that the power has sort of shifted because you have so much user-generated content getting viewership. So the actual content provider, you know, it's definitely not a commodity, but there are alternatives now. So it's, you know, we might see a power shift where internet companies can definitely, you know, come to the table with more power.
I was going to say that it probably, if you have the choice to you know, give it up or not, you would do it on a case-by-case basis by judging, you know, who's evil. Is it the content company that really unneededly needs that information and just wants to crack down for the sake of it? Or is it the user who's maliciously tried to, say, rebroadcast the whole show? Or are they really snipping out the funny part that, you know, I don't see the problem with that, so... It really depends case by case basis.
So that could lead to a good segue into a different topic to change the subject towards product design. I'd like to hear what thoughts our panelists have about balancing the need for maximum accessibility for mass market adoption on one hand with, on the other hand, the cool cutting edge technologies that they're exposed to on a regular basis working in this field.
Sure. Well, so it's kind of an interesting question. In 2005, when just a few months after we launched, we incorporated RSS sharing. So you could take any folder in your account and produce an RSS feed for it. So if you had collaborators or whatever, and they wanted to get the constant updates of your documents or photos or whatever that you're publishing sort of to your account, that you could share that with them. And so it's totally a nerdy thing at the time. It's totally cool because it was, automated, distribution, but it didn't, it didn't take off at all. But then, if you look forward, you could use the same technology and wrap it in some more of a consumer interface, like a widget or a Splashcast player, and it totally takes off because it's just how you represent it and how you show it to the user. So you can actually have sort of fundamentally, you can have really cool technology as long as you don't expose that to the user and you provide it to them in a way that they can understand and consume it. In a way that makes sense for their, activity on your service. So that's what we've seen.
Yeah, so usability is a big thing. I mean, if your customers can't use it, what good is it? I mean, there's always something better down the road. So what's, being cutting-edge technology, how many advanced features can you throw at them fast enough without overwhelming them or having a poor UI? And probably a problem everybody faces, being a desktop application or a web application, you've got to get the user engaged. And we take as Coolbyte, we take a lot of time to try and figure out what's the best balance. And eventually you get into the it's highly customizable for your user. Being able to, like you said, widgets, being able to place things around how you want them. You don't want to see this, but you want to see that. Great deal of time has to be spent on that, but not too much time, or else somebody else does it, and then it's all over. It's all for naught. So again, it doesn't matter what web or desktop. It's a problem for everybody. So,
and if I got 5 more seconds onto my point, the other interesting thing is just the amount of development that is going into products in the tech space or web 2.0 space or whatever is far exceeds, in my opinion, sort of the rate at which consumers can understand and actually intake this kind of stuff. So the problem is when you're in a competitive space, your inclination is to constantly improve and add features and innovate, but the consumer hasn't even close, to caught up to where your original idea was. So and in the storage space is very interesting because we started it because the idea was that online storage is way more efficient, way more usable than carrying around thumb drives and emailing yourself files and all these types of things. It's still 2.5 years later or whatever since we originally came up with the idea, and it's still not a mass market product. And so we could still have our same interface as we did on day one and be just as usable to the market, but because of, the competitive landscape, we constantly have to innovate and improve things and make sure that we sort of stay on top of what's interesting and ride that curve. So.
That's a really good point because I feel like we've been there with Amiga as well. Mm. Well, for us, that question is very relevant because we've seen from just the way the site is being used, there's usually one, family fanatic in a larger family network, a person who really wants to organize the whole family and have all the documents digged up and kind of, organized and saved for the future and all the photos are all scanned in, all the old photos, all the new ones are tagged perfectly, etc. And for that user, we need Amigly to have a large number of features to satisfy that need to fully archive, fully organize. Just everything has to be perfect for that user. On the other hand, we have the 81 years old grandmother in Bulgaria, my grandmother, who barely got internet literally a month ago, just so that she can use Skype, and who loves to see the new photos of, our baby. So for her, it needs to be as simple as going to a web address and something playing. She can't even press play. So it's been a constant balance for us of how do we make that interface work. And I'm not sure we're doing the best job possible, but I think we're you know, we have the basic stuff worked out. And I think the answer really is, you know, provide an interface that can become more complex and layered in, as possible, but also have the, you know, symbolic large play button. Very, you know, obvious, straight from the start.
And you also have to learn when to say no in terms of feature development.
Absolutely.
So, and not go too far.
Yeah, I think learning when to say no is important. Learning when to override your users. I think we get tons of feedback from our users. We have this community of people who are building web applications, and they interact with our service through web applications. So you can imagine, you know, they all give us advice and a lot of tips and a lot of good stuff too. But you know, at some point, you have to make the call of what you're going to listen to and what you're going to leave out and because for the greater good, so to speak. I think one of the key decisions that we made early on was, before Moso and Media Temple and some of these other providers that take kind of a cluster service and put an application on top of it, your main options were simple shared hosting, dedicated servers, and then some reseller type programs. And a lot of times with a dedicated server, you'd get a control panel like Plesk or HSphere or cPanel or something like this. When we started trying to put Moso together, we didn't really want to build this whole control panel type application to manage websites and databases. We thought surely there's something out there that we can take and buy off the shelf and use and get a head start on it. But when we started looking at them, one of the things that struck us is they didn't talk about things in the way that we thought about them. If you wanted to create a website that had email, then in a lot of these control panels, you'd have to go to three or four different screens, and you'd set up the DNS in one spot, and you'd create the website record in one spot, and you'd create the email, you know, the MX records and the email accounts in another spot. If you wanted to install an SSL cert, you had to go to the IP section and make sure that you attach the SSL cert to an IP, and then you go back to the website. And it's, you know, it seemed crazy to us that they were built from the perspective of a system administrator, you know, the person who was building the application. And so one of the decisions we made early on is that we wanted to make sure that we used the vocabulary of our user. There's a book called Domain Driven Design. It's a software development book, and I highly recommend it. And that's one of the points that he iterates again and again and again. Once you start to design some type of bigger system, you want to define the domain and come up with a vocabulary for it that's consistent and that's understandable by all of the people on both sides of the interface. And so I think that's one of the key things. And besides our interface, which is only a piece of our product, we have the technology offerings. One feature we have, we call it True Hybrid, and it basically allows you to run any of our technologies on the same site. So you can have a single site and a single folder that has ASP files and PHP files and Perl files in it. And this is something that I think we were probably the first people to get out there. There are a couple other sites that or a couple other hosting providers that do similar things now. But this is another core decision that we made early on. If the user didn't need to choose, we didn't want to make them choose. We wanted to just take care of it for them. So it was a lot harder on our part to build that system, but we think that there's a lot of value in doing the hard things, making our job harder so that our users' lives are easier. I think those are kind of the two of the core concepts that drive our decision about what we're going to put in and how we do it.
So what's an example of something that everybody here would really like to be able to offer their users but is unable to right now because of the state of the market or their users or their own technology or the state of technology in general that you hope that you'll be able to somewhere around the bend?
Sure. So actually this does tie into the last point. You know, we wish we could give our users some, you know, better desktop access to their files and, you know, easier way to interface with, you know, the media that they're sharing or uploading. The problem is from our testing, we saw that our power users were actually using this tool, you know, for automated backups and a lot of things that our business model didn't support. So it's kind of interesting because we had this problem where it's totally useful, you know, totally useful tool, but it would drive our costs and not necessarily produce any additional revenue for us. And it wasn't really the model that we were trying to pursue as a business. So, you know, that's just one problem we're dealing with, where the technology is there, but the user behavior isn't, and our ability to message it or produce it properly to push the behavior in the right direction isn't there yet. So
that's related to a question I was considering asking about what the most obnoxious behavior on the part of your users that you see is. So.
Well, which one do you want to go with first?
Go for it. Either one.
I'll go for features. What I like to offer my users. It'd probably be just Mac and Linux support. You know, we're Windows only right now, which, I'm sure a lot of people here at South by Southwest want to boo and hiss Windows. I've seen more Macs here than anywhere else on Earth and outside of the Apple booth at the shows. But Windows makes the most sense right off the back for us because, you know, we've got some real great partnerships with companies like AMD, who've got, up to 16 processors in a single box right now, going to 32 processors. And so you think to yourself, as content creators, you know, what am I going to do with 32 processors? You're going to encode a piece of video hellaciously fast is what you're going to do with it. So, you know, HD movies, 1080p, and, you know, instead of days, it's, you know, maybe 15 minutes. So, you know, we're also working with people like, again, AMD and some of our other partners for some HPC systems, some clusters. So we're talking 1,000 processors in a box in a system, all doing one piece of video. So you're talking, export out of a Premiere or Avid or whatever. And, you know, by the time you walk over to get your cup of coffee, your 1080p movie is done. H.264, VC1, Flash 8 if you even want to go into HD web content. So, but again, we want to be able to bring that experience to Mac and Linux users. Linux users first, I like them better. But by proxy, you get Mac with Linux if you do it right. So that's where we're looking at. And most annoying users, just the people that just thrash the settings in a video encode. You can really make a crappy looking piece of video if you're not careful. So again, that plays into that UI. You got to have the right combination to where if you know what you're doing, you can do great things. If not, just leave it the hell alone. So
for us, probably integrating Amiglia better with mobile devices is something that we'd really love to develop. Sending the newest photos and videos to a person's cell phone, for example, when it's time to share them. Getting the birthday reminders out to cell phones. And, why not, browse your family tree on your cell phone? I don't know. Is there a flash player out there for cell phones?
There is.
All right.
Well, we have a lot of technologies that we'd like to be able to offer our users. Right now we have PHP versions 4 and 5. We have ASP, we have .NET, we have MySQL databases versions 4 and 5, and we're working on 6, SQL Server 2000, 2005. And so, you know, one of the main things we want to do is we want to be able to continuously add new technologies as they come along to our environment so that our users can work with the latest and greatest stuff. So I think one of the big ones would obviously be Rails. That one was, missing from the list for sure. And, that's one that we've been working on for a while, but the current state of Rails hosting is do any of you here work with Rails at all? Anybody? Ruby on Rails? All right, so
Union Pacific, the Ruby.
So it's one of the hot new development platforms that a lot of people are using is developed by a Chicago company called 37 Signals. And it makes prototyping and getting web applications up just very, very quick. But the language and the framework are pretty robust, and they have some great features. But the hosted side of it is the landscape has been changing like crazy, and there's always a new way that's considered best practice for doing that. And so for us, it's made it difficult to figure out what the appropriate way to do it is. And we don't want to put something out there that's not going to be a good experience for our customers. In terms of the most annoying thing our users do, I love our users. They don't do anything annoying. I don't know, actually. I've never really thought about that, but it probably has something to do with the pace at which they expect us to continue to grow and add new features. I mean, they are a bunch of web geeks, and so they always want to be playing with the newest stuff out there. It makes it hard for our systems department to keep up with all of this stuff.
So what about mobile? Do y'all believe that there really is going to be substantial demand to consume media on mobile devices?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got think of every Asia-Pacific cell phone that comes out these days has got, flashlight. You know, the flashlight to the new players. I mean, they use their cell. That's their lifeline. And, you know, I'm sure it's going to do nothing but spread over here to, Europe and then over here to North America. And, it's the same level of stuff that you get, on the desktop. I think they're even doing the higher quality video now. It's just really engaging. If it can capture their attention, the Asia Pacific guys, Japan, they've had HD, they've had these, fiber to the home for years and years. So if it can capture their attention, I'm sure they've got the much shorter attention spans than we do. And it seems to be doing well over there. So I'm sure we can all jump on the trend. And what do you do after the web? You go to the mobile web. So,
it's kind of tough for me to touch on this because I think I'm out of touch with reality because I sit on the computer all day. So I never really have any use for mobility. But a lot of people compare where mobile is going because they look at Asia and everything. I think that probably the behaviors are a bit different, and since they've been brought up with all of that, their means of communicating, at least from what I understand, is with mobile devices much more so than computer terminals. So it's probably a behavioral thing for people to get into all this kind of stuff. For a company like Box, where you have a lot of personal media and possibly commercial media coming into you, it is important to move beyond just the computer terminal and allow you to access that and view it from your BlackBerry or whatever. So we have a site called m.box.net, and if you pull it up on your HTML-enabled phone, you can actually just, browse your files. Very simple tasks. Personally, I've only used it once when I needed to share a file with someone, but we've heard stories similar where you're sort of on the go and you need to pull up a file from your box and send it to someone. So there is some utility there.
I don't know that there's a lot that we can add to that. I mean, we power it, I guess, but in terms of actually, one thing that we have had to do is we've had to make sure that our email architectures are able to do the push mail that a lot of people are wanting. It's
okay.
Well, I'm personally waiting for the phone that has a really good camera, because a lot of the phones have crappy cameras out there, so that you can take really good photos and videos and then hopefully geotag them on the go. And, to that respect, I think Amiglia is going to have, a lot to benefit from better mobile devices. And I also think it can also help our growth if we push the content out to the mobile devices as well.
So before we go on and on, I wonder if there's anybody out there with any burning questions they'd like to ask this diverse group of company representatives. If so, let us know. Oh, there's one.
Yep. Can't remember your first name.
Sorry. Yeah, it's Chris.
Chris, what type of services would you provide for online video sites? I run an online video site, and we do some transcoding, but we'd love to kind of, as we scale, we'd love to kind of work with partners.
Sure. So we're kind of the people behind the scenes. Think of anybody that's a user-generated video site. Of course, all that video's got to be encoded somehow. There's, two ways. Our software can either sit on the server side. You can have it just, again, it is, if you got the right machines, which are coming down in price, You know, 16-core servers aren't incredibly expensive like you might think. You know, with server side, you just let the software run, and every time you could have a watch folder or a web service, and that just every time a video is uploaded, it encodes it. And again, it is so fast that you would have, as long as you don't have a big backlog to start with, you'd get the instant gratification from your users. You don't have to wait 2 weeks, 2 months for their content to show up on the website. You know, if you didn't have a big backlog to start, you know, there'd be maybe a couple minute wait, and you know, it'd pop out the other side, and you know, just instant gratification. Second way is, you know, there's client side services, via people like Onto or resellers like Coolabyte or enhancers like Coolabyte, to where you can have your users encode on the client side, you know, so using their processor. You know, dual core computers are about all you see anymore at the store. I haven't seen a single core computer in quite some time for sale. So it's going to quad cores, then it's going to go to dual quad cores. So you can have 8 cores, and you know, in your Macs or whatever else you're using, and you know, to be able to leverage all that on one video encode with our software is just an amazing thing. Usually, you don't do that with video. It's not that easy to multi-thread it out. So again, you know, two ways: client side, you know, save yourself some hardware money, or server side, and you know, save your users a little bit of headaches. So
that's part of the story that doesn't get talked about in public, I think, as much as some of the other things. While everybody was asking how is YouTube going to make money, you know, Limelight Networks and other people behind the scenes were making plenty of money well before the acquisition, and still today. So it's good to hear some juicy details.
So Coolabyte.com to further answer the question. But again, there's some great things we can do. Around April, we'll have our products and trials out, so you can give it a go if you've got a Windows computer.
My apologies if anybody's discussed this. Is anybody in the panel feel like addressing doing, in terms of distribution, doing statistics for reporting and tracking of downloads? For me, my primary concern would be video. But outside of the Flash universe, there's sort of a miserable array of pathetic options for tracking completed downloads going to end users that you can use to verify your distribution with advertisers and other people who pay you money for distributing content.
Well,
we're probably one of those miserable companies. So you're talking about making sure that the video has been fully watched. So you
the whole fully watched thing is a fantasy. I got 5.5 years in broadcast TV before this, right? Nielsen's is a consensus hallucination, but it happens to be the one the industry is built on. Uh-huh. Let's get away from metaphysics. Literally, just talk about, you know, a completed download from, you know, my CDN or my website or your service, right, and verifying it. You know, if somebody's coming up to download, you mentioned Limelight. Let's say I've got video hosted on Limelight and they're coming through the Windows Media server or the Windows Media Player, or if they're coming through IE, right? The background intelligent transfer service comes in from IE, which means I get 4,000 requests for every single completed download, right? So requests aren't usable. If I do initiated downloads based on doing a redirect through a secondary server, those numbers scale 15 to 50% high because more files are initiated than are actually completed. If I track it through Flash, if I do an FLV server, I pay 60 to 90 cents a gigabyte, and I can actually track FLV files. But if I do HTTP downloads, to do 7 cents to 21 cents a gigabyte, depending on the robustness of the system, I lose the ability to track through the FLV server. So unless I want to move everything onto an FLV server, double my production costs, cut out 80% of my audience, what do you guys think people are going to use moving forward to verify completed downloads?
So who are you?
My name is Patrick Norton. I run video and audio for Ziff Davis Media, DLTV, Cranky Geeks, a bunch of podcasts.
Cool. Okay.
Well, the only thing I would suggest is, you know, there's you have the ability, especially with FLVs and with some of the other containers as well, you have the ability to add in a lot of metadata throughout that video.
Right. Issue with FLV, which FLV is great if I'm CNN and I want to build an incredibly expensive, highly structured system that keeps my users on my website, but 40% of my users are rolling through iTunes. Another 40% of my users are downloading in the format they want to download and be able to move to portable devices or move throughout the home network. Flash doesn't offer me an option for that. 80% of my users don't use Flash. some of the websites I work with on a consulting basis, 98% of their users don't want to use Flash.
Really?
So I'm probably FLV, great, metadata. If I can throw money at the problem, FLV.
Well, let me ask you kind of an off question. Why don't they like Flash? Is it just the quality or?
Well, if you ever tried to put Flash on a home theater system?
Yeah.
Or if you ever tried to put Flash on a portable device? If you ever tried to save Flash so you can watch it later? If you ever tried to save Flash so you can use it on a plane?
Yeah,
the people at Adobe are addressing some of these issues, but it's still going to be a proprietary container built around Adobe software.
There's a lot of proprietary.
And then there's the whole audio
technology around that Flash, and it's going to be a lot tougher than say H.264. Even Microsoft gives you a lot more flexibility than Flash does. It is a can of worms with Flash.
I mean, there's also it's cool that Adobe bought the folks from Serious Magic, which means they actually have some really talented video engineers moving in there who have broadcast experience, who thinks things like audio and visual syncing are a big plus in video.
Yeah. Video engineers are great. CEOs are better.
They have a
hand the orders down. That's how you got to get.
They have the new strategic director for all of video operations at Adobe came out of Serious Magic, right? So he's been doing video enabling for people with less money for a long time. That's a good thing. It still doesn't solve my problem with 80% of my users not wanting to use Flash, though.
Okay. I think you probably
completed downloads.
I think you probably are more of an expert on this than any of us, unfortunately.
You guys are the panel, man. Somebody had
you got a mic bullet too.
That's a really important topic for sure, one of a number this particular selection of people I don't think
you've got some problems. So say you do figure out this one solution, you got all these deployments, and it's going to be you got to have you're looking for something that sits on top of it, all the different formats.
Even somebody like a Limelight or Akamai don't really bother to track completed downloads at any meaningful level. They'll track your bandwidth and they'll get you a bill to the end of the month. And sometimes they'll make mistakes.
Well, there's got to be a way to check. I mean, you can check the file integrity of these, even of a stream.
If I'm sitting there and I'm like, I want you to distribute your content through my system, are you guys going to sit down and track individual IP through data bit rates to give an idea when a completed download is done to keep a tally for people? Is that a service you guys care about offering?
Okay. There could probably not even just a panel, but I'm sure there are whole conferences on that. There should be.
Yeah.
So I just got a signal in the back. We're just about out of time. I wonder if.
But you can beat up on me later if you'd like. I'll be hanging around.
I still want to talk about the encoding stuff.
Okay. No problem.
As we wrap up, do the people on the panel have. A particular meme, if you will, around distribution and a new distribution that either through this conversation has struck you as the most, what you're most interested in, or anything that you'd like to bring to the discussion that we haven't discussed so far in 140 characters or less.
Tell your friends to use Box.
Box. Yeah. I mean, again, I'll do some shameless self-promotion. I mean, Coolabyte.com. I mean, we're trying to do some fun things. So check us out. You want to. Come on. You can say Coolabyte.com if you'd like.
I think one of the interesting things to watch over the next couple of years is how the technologies that have been around for a while, things like Apache. Apache's been around forever, and it's just kind of the standard in web servers. But new technologies that are gaining massive popularity, like the Rails framework, they don't run as most technologies would with Apache. They don't play well with FastCGI or CGI. They don't run as an Apache module. So I think around the distribution, and probably because I'm in hosting, that is where I think. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how these technologies change to accommodate things like tracking these new files and that we haven't really had to track before. We haven't cared about if a GIF or a JPEG that's embedded in a web page, does it get all the way downloaded or not? And that's kind of what all of the systems are built around. And Rails is a single-threaded application that you can't run in parallel. And so there are a lot of new problems that are coming out. And I think in the next couple of years there'll be a lot of new solutions for them. And that's what I think is going to be very interesting to watch.
Well, I personally find the fact that there are so many difficult, unanswered questions still an indication that the industry is really, really young, which ordinarily might go without saying. but It's also a sign to me that the established market leaders are not as established as some people seem to think that they are. Mm-hmm. And that with all these unanswered questions lie the possibility for market churn and new leaders to emerge in a wide variety of ways.
That's right. Yeah, the small companies are a lot more agile than the large, which is why, you know, small companies get a chance to become large ones. So it would be a... We'll have lots to talk about next year, I'm sure.
Good. Well, thank you very much for coming and staying. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Marshall.